Okay, so now they're all ready to go. I'm Seth Lazar. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the School of Philosophy in the Center for Moral, Social, and Political Theory. And we're very pleased to have here today Theron Palmer from St Andrews and from St Anne's College in Oxford. Theron is a friend of mine. He's been working on the moral philosophy of utilitarianism and effective altruism. Besides his actual work in moral philosophy, he's been part of this group, Giving What We Can, of which there is a chapter here at ANU and in Canberra, which is an organization to coordinate people in donating money towards effective charities. And so I thought I would ask him, rather than just giving a philosophy talk, to give a talk that would speak to the philosophy behind Giving What We Can. And we're very pleased that he was able to come here today and do this. So he's going to talk for about 50 or so minutes. We'll have a little break, and then there'll be some time for questions afterwards. Then there'll be a reception in the foyer outside. I've been told to warn you that after a certain time, we will be locked in. But don't worry, that's not to ensure that everybody donates a bunch of money to Giving What We Can or something. You just have to press the green button to get out, and you'll be able to do so. Okay, hopefully we won't need to keep you physically in the building in order to keep you in the building. But it's a great pleasure to introduce Theron, and yeah, look forward to hearing what you've got to say.
So does everyone have a handout? Okay, all right. So I'm very honored to be here at ANU giving this public lecture. I'm especially grateful to the School of Philosophy and the Center for Moral, Social, and Political Theory. Seth, obviously, Christian Berry, Nicholas Southwood, and Katie Wilson as well. So Katie helped design the poster. I tried to design a poster earlier, but then Seth said in response, you didn't miss your calling. So it's a good thing that somebody else was in charge of that. And thanks to all of you for showing up. So to start off, I'd like to give you a bit of a sense of the scope and severity of the problem that I'll be discussing today. And I'll do that by giving you some facts about extreme poverty. So this is on the handout. 2.4 billion people live on less than $2 per day. More than 1 billion people lack access to clean drinking water. More than 800 million people go to bed hungry each night. More than 6 million children die each year from preventable diseases. That's on average 16,000 deaths per day, which to put things just in quantitative terms, to make a quantitative comparison, is like five 9/11s happening each day. So this is clearly a very significant tragedy that's happening. Some people are optimistic that we could put an end to this tragedy with $30 billion each year. There's some estimates that that would be enough to provide basic nutritional and educational needs for everyone. You might think, that's a lot of money. But actually, relative to some other figures, it's not a lot of money. It's actually 10 times less than the amount of money that Americans spent on tobacco products in just 1 year, in 2010. But even if it's not a lot of money relative to some other figures, it's still a lot of money relative to what each of us makes. And you might think, I'm just one person, what can I do about this? And the truth is that even though you're just one person, you can do a lot of good. And here are some examples of the good you can do. You could prevent a malaria-caused death for $2,000, and in the process prevent many non-fatal instances of malaria. You could repair an obstetric fistula for $400. You could restore sight to someone for $20. And you could treat a child's parasitic worms for as little as 50 cents. This is, of course, if you give to effective charities. So again, even if the difference that you can make relative to the billions that are suffering in extreme poverty, even if the difference you could make relative to that is small, the difference that you could make in absolute terms is surely very large by any standard. All right, so far I've just been describing some facts about extreme poverty and some facts about what you can do to intervene. But ethics is about more than just describing the way the world is. It's about morally assessing acts as right or wrong, as better or worse. Ethics is about
the most fundamental practical question that an agent can ask, what should I do? And I'll be offering three claims about what we should do in the context of giving to charity. One, we should give to charities helping people in extreme poverty. Two, we should, at least with a few qualifications, give to whatever charities we find to be most cost-effective. And three, we should give considerably more than what most people give to charity. I could argue for these claims by appealing to some general level ethical principle like utilitarianism. So utilitarianism is the view that I ought always to maximize total well-being. That general principle would probably entail claims 1, 2, and 3. But I won't be appealing to utilitarianism or any other very general ethical principle in order to defend claims 1, 2, and 3. Instead, I'll be using a case-based methodology. I'll be appealing to plausible beliefs or intuitions about particular actual and hypothetical cases, and then defending claims 1 through 3 using those and arguments by analogy. I could get into the advantages of using this sort of methodology. I think they're deep. There are good philosophical reasons for doing it, but one pragmatic reason for doing it is that there's more widespread agreement about some of the particular cases I'll be appealing to. So I'm hoping to build up my case for claims 1, 2, and 3 from premises that more people already would accept. Okay, so why give? My first claim is that we should give to charities helping people in extreme poverty. And I'm setting aside temporarily the questions of where to give and how much to give. But it's important to note when talking about what we should do, what I mean by should exactly. So in saying that we should give to charities helping in extreme poverty, I'm not merely saying that it would be a nice thing or a praiseworthy thing for us to do that. I mean, it would be that, but it wouldn't merely be that. I'm claiming that it would be wrong not to give to these charities. Now, that might strike some of you as absurd. You might think, I have not just a legal right to my property and my money, but I have a moral right to my money, where this moral right entails that I have permission to do with my money what I please, as long as I'm not harming anyone, say, or violating anyone's rights. If this claim, if this appeal to property rights is meant to imply that it's permissible for me never to give anything to charity, then I will be arguing against this sort of view of property rights. This isn't to deny that property rights exist. It's just to deny that they could generate such strong permissions not to give. Okay, now let's turn to the first hypothetical case. This is a famous case many of you have probably heard of before. It comes from Peter Singer's 1972 article called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. It's the drowning child case. So on your way to a lecture, for example, you see a child drowning in a shallow pond. Only you could rescue the child. You could rescue the child without any risk to your life or health. But in order to save the child, because of the urgency of the situation, you'd have to rush into the pond quickly, muddying and ruining your shoes and clothing. So there is a cost to you of doing this. Should you save the child in this case? Would it be wrong of you not to save the child in this case? It seems that the answer to both is yes. Not only, when we think about the positive side of this, though, it's not just that it would be wrong if you didn't save the child, but think about the positive side of this. If you did save the child, think about how great you'd feel. Now, let me remind you of something. You can give money to effective charities, and you can save a life. Shouldn't you feel just as good if you save a life that way? And shouldn't you feel that it's wrong if you fail to save a life that way? Many people think it would be morally okay not to save a life by not giving to life-saving charities. But it seems plausible, and this is under Section 3 now, that if it's wrong not to help in the drowning child situation, then it's wrong not to help in the giving to charity situation. Why do I claim this? It seems that the two situations are relevantly similar. In both situations, you're presented with an opportunity to do a lot of good for others at a small cost to yourself. That seems to be what explains why you should help in both cases. If one is to resist my claim that if it's wrong not to help in the drowning child situation, then it's wrong not to help in the giving to charity situation, then one would have to point to some morally relevant difference between the two situations. Now, of course, there are plenty of differences between the two situations. Only one of the situations involves a pond. Only one of the two situations involves a credit card transaction. But those clearly aren't morally relevant differences. And there are many other differences between the two situations that are not morally relevant. So our job isn't to just point to some difference, but one that seems to be morally significant. What about distance? In the drowning child situation, you're very close to the drowning child. In the giving to charity situation, you're far away from the child or children that you could save through your donations. Well, typically, it's true that you're better able to help people who are physically closer to you. But that's not true here. You could very easily and very greatly help people who are on other continents by giving to charity. And physical distance doesn't seem to matter morally as such or in and of itself. What about social distance? Whether you have the same race or nationality or ethnicity as the person that you're helping. This doesn't seem to be very morally significant either. We could just imagine a revised version of the drowning child case where the child is of a different nationality and different ethnicity than you. And it seems clearly wrong to let that child die. What about the uncertainty involved? It's true that when you give to charity, there's a chance that your donation won't save any lives. So if you give about $1,000 to the Against Malaria Foundation, that would distribute a bunch of malaria nets, but it would only bring about a 50% chance that someone's life would actually be saved. So what we can do to make the drowning child case similar to that case is just suppose that your shoes and clothing are worth $1,000 and that you only have a 50% chance of saving the child. It still seems it would be deeply wrong of you not to save the child in that case. So pointing to uncertainty doesn't seem to be a very promising way of finding the morally relevant difference between drowning child type situations and giving to charity type situations. What about the thought of the further disastrous future that Peter Unger refers to? So this thought is sort of a mouthful, but the idea is that, look, if I save this child by giving to an effective charity, then this child will have children, and the child's children will have children, and then there'll just be a lot more people in the future who need saving. So what I've done actually is make the situation worse. I think that, at least for a lot of cases of giving, this thought is just empirically false. So there are many charities you could give to, Oxfam, Against Malaria Foundation, UNICEF, that engage in life-saving activities, where these life-saving activities actually, in the long run, would stabilize population size. So there's actually a positive connection between reduced infant and child mortality rates and stable population growth. You might remain a bit skeptical. You might think there's still something dubious about extending the lives of people in developed countries. You might worry about how good that is. But even if so, you could give to charities that don't affect or extend the length of lives, but instead affect their quality. So people suffering from parasitic infections like schistosomiasis, this isn't a fatal kind of illness, but it does decrease quality of life. So by giving to something like Schistosomiasis Control Initiative or Deworm the World, you could improve someone's quality of life without affecting the length of their life. Okay, so that's another possible difference, this thought of the disastrous further future, but I don't think that'll quite do it either. What about the fact that in the drowning child case, only you can help. This isn't the case with the giving to charity situation. There are many people, many rich individuals, as well as rich governments that could help people in extreme poverty. And arguably, the rich governments are under an even stronger obligation to do something about it. Does the fact that all of these people could do something about it reduce your obligation to help? Seems to me that this isn't a very promising way to go. If it's true, or if it seems likely, that these people who could help won't help. So you could imagine a version, again, of the drowning child case, where there are other people standing around who you know could save the drowning child, but they're standing like this. They're doing something to indicate that they're not going to help. So it seems likely to you that they're not going to do anything. Their presence doesn't make it okay for you. The fact that they could help doesn't make it okay for you not to help. So this doesn't seem to be yet a morally relevant difference either. Now here's one that might be. The drowning child case is just a one-off kind of case. After you save the drowning child, you can dust off your hands and walk away. Your job is done. That's it. You save the drowning child. Good job. But if you give some money to an effective charity, that's not the end of the story. You could get another request from maybe the very same charity or a different charity. The giving to charity situation is a recurring one. You might think that's relevant, and it probably is. So this gets at the issue of how much we ought to give to effective charities, and I'll be taking that up a bit later. But for now, I think it's safe to claim that if it's wrong not to help in the drowning child situation, then it's wrong not to help at least once in the giving to charity situation, where your helping in that situation would be enough to save a life. Okay. Notice that appealing to property rights doesn't block this conclusion. If property rights made it permissible for you not to give $2,000 to an effective charity, then presumably they would also make it permissible for you not to wade in and save the drowning child. But it seems implausible that it's permissible for you not to wade in and save the drowning child. So this appeal to property rights doesn't, in my view, succeed. It's, again, not that I'm denying the existence of property rights, but I'm claiming that they couldn't plausibly generate such strong permissions. So to sum up this section, you should give to cost-effective charities helping people in extreme poverty, as long as the cost to you is relatively small. Okay, next I'll turn to the question of where to give. The Oxford philosopher, Toby Ord, once said that it's more morally important where to give than whether to give to charity at all. And he said this because he's aware of the fact that some charities are thousands of times more cost-effective than others. And one of his favorite examples is charities that help blind people. So there are some charities that train seeing eye dogs, and what they do is they provide a guide dog for a blind person that helps them improve their quality of life. It costs about $40,000 to train the seeing eye dog and train the recipient of the dog. Now, I take it that if you donated to this charity, you'd be doing good. It's a good thing to help this blind person. But what Toby points out is that you could instead give to the Fred Hollows Foundation or Sight Savers International, and you could restore sight in someone for $20. So you could either help one blind person with your $40,000, or with the same $40,000, you could help 2,000 blind people, and you'd be helping them to at least the same degree. You'd be restoring their sight. So it seems that at least when other things are equal, you should help the greater number of people. Here's another nearby case to help illustrate that we can call two lakes. So suppose that you're standing in between East Lake, where there's one child drowning, and West Lake, where there are 100 children drowning. And you're in between them, and you see that there's a boat, and you could launch this boat into one lake or the other, You can't launch it into both. So you can't save all 101 people. All 101, by the way, are strangers to you, let's suppose. What should you do in this case?
It seems that it would be wrong in this case
to save the one over the 100. You should save the 100. And you might wonder, why should things be any different in the context of charitable donation? If we should save the greater number in this nearby case, then shouldn't we save the greater number with our donations too? It doesn't seem to be a very deep difference between the Two Lakes case and giving to charity cases that there's money involved in the charity situation. We could just introduce money into the Two Lakes case if we like. So you could suppose it costs $2,000 to rent this boat. It's locked in place, and in order to get the boat, you have to insert a credit card quickly. It's an emergency, you better do it quick, and it'll charge your credit card $2,000. And then once it charges it, it'll unlock the boat, and you can kick it into this lake or into this other lake instead. Seems that you'd be morally required in that case to insert your credit card and unlock the boat. And then it seems that if you did that, you'd be morally required to save the greater number, the 100 over the 1. In fact, it seems to me that even if you weren't morally required to pay that cost of $2,000, even if it weren't required, that is, it's permissible not to do that, if you did unlock the boat, then you would be required to save the 100 over the 1. It's important to point this out because there might be many cases where people have permission not to offer assistance for a variety of different reasons, but it doesn't follow from this sort of permission not to offer assistance that one has total permission with respect to where one offers one's assistance. Out of two acts that involve a sacrifice and assisting behavior on your part, if one of them does much more good for other people, but is not significantly costlier to you, it seems like you should perform that act, even if you're permitted not to perform either of the sacrificial acts. So it seems to me that these lessons about nearby rescue cases carry over to the context of charity situations. If you can give your money to charity X and save one life, or you can give the same amount to charity Y and save 100 lives, then if you're going to give to charity at all, and if it's not significantly costlier to you to give to charity Y, then you should do so. When I say that it's not significantly costlier to you to give to charity Y, I'm not just thinking in monetary terms. Some people give for highly personal reasons. It might be not just a cost in terms of your well-being to give to a particular charity, but in terms of what Williams calls your ground projects or your connections or people that are near and dear to you. Those costs would factor into what I'm referring to as significant costs. So if they were in play, then what I'm saying here is consistent with it being permissible that you give to the less cost-effective charity. But as long as it's not significantly costlier to you to give to the more cost-effective charity, then I'm claiming you should do so. In comparing these nearby rescue cases with the distant rescue cases, the giving to charity situations, it's important to keep in mind a number of other factors that can distort our intuitions about these cases. So in the nearby cases, the individuals that you could help are right up close to you. You can see them. Their need is very conspicuous to you. That's not the case in with respect to giving to charity. And often some charities will exploit this by giving photos of one particular child. The charities that give photos of one particular child and maybe offer a name to tend to get more donations than charities that simply offer facts and figures. So it's important to keep this in mind. It's also important to keep in mind the demotivating power of futility thinking. So I've already noted this at the beginning of the lecture. This is thinking that you're not really making a difference because there's still such a huge problem out there. So when you save the drowning child, or when you save the 100 over the 1, you can think, well, we've ended the situation. I've done my good, and things are now over. But if I give some money to an effective charity, even if I do the same amount of good, I might feel like I haven't made as big a difference because relative to the ongoing problem, it is smaller. But it seems that what really matters isn't how big a difference you make relative to the overall problem that exists, but how big a difference you make in absolute terms. And you might be interested to know that we succumb to all sorts of biases of futility thinking. So there's an experiment from psychology showing that people prefer to save 80 people out of 100 in a camp who all would need to be saved over saving 200 people out of a camp of 1,000 people who would need saving. So this seems like an irrational kind of cognitive bias, and it's something that we should avoid succumbing to when thinking about where to give. Okay, so again, the point is just that we should keep in mind how the lessons from nearby rescue cases can translate over to giving to charity cases. I think that we should give to the most cost-effective charities, at least as long as we're giving, and at least as long as it's not significantly costlier to us to do so. But it'd be good now to just step back for a second and talk about what I mean by cost effectiveness. So there's a weaker and a stronger sense of cost effectiveness. The weaker sense refers to simply bang for your buck. And the idea here is just within some particular charity category, we should be efficient. So if what you care about is apples, then the idea is try to find the way to get the most apples per dollar. The blindness example that I gave earlier fits this schema. So the thought is we care about helping blind people. You could help more or fewer blind people with a fixed donation size. Another and stronger sense of cost effectiveness has to do with weighing up different kinds of goods. Not just apples, but apples and oranges, and attempting to determine how much good you'd get if you took your X dollars and got 50 apples and 700 oranges. So here, in determining overall goodness, we have to prioritize different causes over others. Examples involve deciding between saving lives, apples, between sparing people of parasitic infections, oranges, and between reducing, bringing about small chances of large goods versus large chances of smaller goods, bananas, or weighing human well-being against animal well-being, pineapples, and so on. So I don't mean to suggest that by calling these last things pineapples and bananas and everything, that these aren't good ideas. The thought is just that there are lots of different dimensions of goodness, and if we're trying to figure out how to get the most good per dollar, it's going to be possibly quite difficult. Now, luckily, within certain areas, we've made progress toward quantifying goodness. So the World Health Organization, for example, uses this measure called the QALY, the Quality Adjusted Life Year. It's a unit of health benefit. And the idea behind the QALY is that we care about more than just saving as many lives as possible. And we care about more than just extending lives as much as possible. But we also care about the quality of the lives that we're extending. So one QALY is 1 year of full health. And then years get discounted, multiplied by some fraction, in accordance with the extent to which they fall short of full health, perhaps due to illness or disability. Okay, and the WHO then ranks health interventions by looking at the total amount of QALYs that you get per dollar. And this is extremely valuable information. They have a lot of charts. You could like look up the cost effectiveness of different interventions in terms of QALYs for. But I think that there remain very deep philosophical questions here. What is it for someone to be benefited? What is well-being consist in? How do you aggregate benefits across different people? You could give, for example, to Against Malaria Foundation, or you could give to Deworm the World. Suppose that you gave the same amount to each, and suppose that they came out roughly the same in terms of total qualities. Well, in the one case, in the Against Malaria case, you'd be saving a life. You'd be providing a big benefit for one person. In the Deworm the World case, you'd be providing many small benefits, each for a separate person. It's a philosophical question there. Which of those is better? Which does more good? And then there are questions about how to balance well-being against other considerations like fairness, equality, priority for the worse off, what people deserve, and so on. So there are apples, oranges, bananas, pineapples, cherries, plums. There's a lot of different kinds of good. It's not that it's impossible to make these comparisons across different types of good. If it were between saving one life and sparing one person of a parasitic infection, obviously I should save the life. But what if I could save one life or spare 100 people of these parasitic infections? Or 1,000 or 10,000? Within a certain range, it becomes very, very difficult and raises, I think, deep questions in ethics, decision theory, and value theory. But even making certain simplifying assumptions about these philosophical issues, there'll be deep empirical problems too. I've already alluded to the issue about the long-term consequences of saving a life for some population. In addition to the World Health Organization, we live in a world now where there are rigorous charity evaluators. So one of the best is called GiveWell. You can go to givewell.org. I'd strongly encourage you to look at their methodology and results at top-ranked charities before you give. Okay, so wrapping up this section. Given that it's uncertain or indeterminate which charities do the most good, it might be that it's equally morally permissible for you to give to a number of different charities that are all very good. They're all within the same category of best, but it's indeterminate which of those is best. But then my claim about where to give kicks in at this point. If you could give to a charity that's much better, and you're giving already, and it's no costlier to you to do so, not significantly costlier to you to do so, then you should give to that much better charity. Okay, now switching gears, returning to the question of how much you should give to charity. This often comes up in philosophy under the more general question of how much of your well-being you could morally be required to sacrifice for the sake of helping others. It gets at what philosophers call the demandingness issue. There's a lack of consensus among philosophers about how demanding morality is. What I'll do is present you with a few different principles that answer give answers to the question of how demanding morality is. So one answer is given by utilitarianism, the theory that you should always do whatever will maximize total well-being. Now, this theory implies that if the only way for me to save two people on the other side of the planet is for me to kill myself, then assuming all the lives in question are equally good, I should kill myself. It'd be wrong of me. Utilitarianism implies it'd be wrong of me not to kill myself in this case. Now, there are some utilitarians who accept this challenge and want to defend utilitarianism in spite of this seemingly counterintuitive implication. But many instead think that utilitarianism is an overly demanding view and try to find different principles that are not so demanding. So earlier, I suggested one principle that's less demanding than utilitarianism when I was saying what it is that explains why it would be wrong not to help in the drowning child case, and likewise wrong not to help in the giving to charity case. That principle is roughly that whenever you could do a lot of good for others at a relatively small cost to yourself, you should do so. On the handout, I have this listed as low cost-benefit ratio. The thought is that as long as the cost to you is sufficiently low and the benefit to others is sufficiently high, then you should incur the cost for the sake of bringing about those benefits. Now, this is far less demanding a principle than utilitarianism. But many people have noted that it faces problems. In particular, it faces problems of iteration. So repeated applications of this principle will drain your well-being slowly over time. So you can imagine getting an email from Deworm the World saying, "Dear Theron, if you give us $200, we'll deworm 400 children. Well, that's a small cost to me and a large benefit to others. Looks like this principle is going to imply that I should pay that cost. Okay, I do. Then I get another email offering me the same deal. Again, it looks like this principle will imply that I should pay the cost. Then I get another email and another email and so on. This principle will only fail to imply that I should put another $200 on my credit card when it's true that doing that would be a not small, a medium-sized maybe, or large cost to me. It's only then that it'd be okay for me not to incur the cost. But then by the time I've gotten down to that low bank account level, I've been made pretty badly off. And some people think that this is a sign that even this more modest cost-benefit ratio principle is still too demanding. And what goes wrong with it is that it doesn't recognize a limit on how much you could be required to sacrifice. So there are people, the philosopher Colity, Garrett Colity, in an essay called Asking Too Much, does espouse limits on how much you could be required to sacrifice. So Colity's view is that you can't be required to incur a serious long-term injury, such as the loss of a limb, for the sake of helping a stranger. Suppose the only way to stop a runaway train from running over and killing one innocent person is by you throwing your leg in front of the train to stop it. Colity thinks that it would not be wrong not to do that, to refuse to do that. And then he argues that the lesson about this nearby case carries over to the context of giving to charity. Colity thinks you would be morally required to give a lot of your money away to help people in extreme poverty, but that you wouldn't be required to give so much that all of your sacrifices in total, when you're considering all your past sacrifices and then the further sacrifice that you're about to make, would add up to be a loss of well-being to you comparable to a serious long-term injury. So you'd be required to make quite a lot of sacrifices, but you would never be required to incur a serious long-term injury. As long as your giving is within the non-serious injury zone, you'd be required to continue giving as long as each of your donations does a lot of good for others, like saves a life, for example. Now, there are others who think that Colity's principle is not sufficiently demanding. So it's less demanding than this cost-benefit ratio principle, but maybe there's still something implausible about Colity's view. Just really quickly, I'll mention one other possibility. Peter Unger, in his book Living High and Letting Die, offers a principle that he calls the reasonable principle of ethical integrity. Might as well have called it like the true principle or something like this, just to present it as fairly as possible. The rough idea behind the principle is that if it's permissible for you to impose a certain cost, C, on someone else in order to bring about some greater good, G, then if you could incur that cost, C, in order to bring about the greater good, G, you'd be required to do that. So the idea is the principle is supposed to create a link between what is permissible for you to impose on others for the sake of the greater good and what is required for you to sacrifice for the sake of the greater good. Now imagine that there's again another train headed down the track where there are two people trapped. And the only way to stop the train from killing these two people is by pulling a lever that would divert it down a sidetrack where one innocent person's leg is trapped. It seems in that case it would be morally okay for you to flip the switch. It'd be okay for you to destroy that one person's leg in order to save two other people's lives. But then notice what the reasonable principle of ethical integrity would imply. It would imply that if the only way to save the two lives were for you to destroy your leg then you'd be required to do that. So his view is much more demanding than Cullity's. Obviously, it implies that you would be required to incur a serious long-term injury for the sake of helping others. And then you could just note what it would imply about giving to charity. Much more stringent demands in that context than Cullity's principle. So there are a variety of reasons that you might not be happy with Cullity's view or might not think it's demanding enough, but I think that it'll actually work for my purposes today, because probably most philosophers, I could be wrong about this, but I would say most philosophers think that morality is at least as demanding as Cullity thinks it is. And then, if Cullity's view is true, we could ask, at least how much should we give to charity? And to answer this question, what we should do, working with Cullity's view, is think about our whole life and how much we would earn over our whole life and how much we could give away of that lifetime income consistent with not incurring a serious long-term injury. And then we could work out a strategy for how to give over the course of our life so that we're doing exactly what Cullity's principle demands of us, so that we're not ever incurring a serious long-term injury. But you might think, actually, giving to charity isn't like incurring a serious long-term injury. So think of the organization Giving What We Can. This is an organization of people who've pledged to give at least 10% of their income away to whatever charities they think will help people, help others the most. The pledge is, by the way, 1% if you don't yet have an income. So students only pledge 1% of their spending money and then 10% of their future income. Most members of Giving What We Can, for what it's worth, do give to these health intervention type charities that I've been talking about. But my point right now is just that the members of Giving What We Can are by no means rich. So they're mostly academics. Many of them are students. Many of them are philosophers. As far as I know, out of nearly 1,000 members, there's only one millionaire. The members of Giving What We Can consistently report that taking the pledge was one of the best decisions that they've ever made. Not just ethical decisions, but prudential decisions. In terms of their own well-being, they say, this was a good idea. It makes them happier. It gives them a sense of meaning in life, like they're making a difference. And actually, there's some psychological studies behind this as well that rely on people's subjective reports of life satisfaction. And it seems to me that if this is true, if this evidence is accurate, and people do feel good when they're giving, this shouldn't detract from the moral quality of that act. If people feel happy when they're doing a lot of good for others, that's just a win-win situation. And if this psychological evidence is accurate, then it's plausible that in order for us to really sacrifice, we'd have to give much more than 10%. So to get into the sacrificial zone, not monetary sacrifices, but sacrifices of your well-being, you'd have to give more than 10%, and probably even much more than that before your sacrifices approximated incurring a serious long-term injury. So it's very plausible, given all that, that most of us living in developed countries and earning even a relatively modest income are morally required to give at least 10% of our income away to effective charities. So that's the third claim that I advertised in the talk, because I said that you should give more than what, considerably more than what most people give, and most people give only around 3%. Okay, so now I want to say a few other things about the ethics of giving. It's not only about how much one should give to charity, and it's not only about which charities one should give to. The ethics of giving is also about what careers one should take up and what one should do with one's time and talents. So money is just one resource that you could donate. The ethics of giving is connected to effective altruism, which I have listed on the handout, is a philosophy and social movement that uses good evidence and reasoning to work out the most effective ways to improve the world. If you want to know more about effective altruism, you could read Peter Singer's new book called The Most Good You Can Do. And giving what we can is actually has been at the core of the effective altruism movement. And giving what we can isn't just about this 10% pledge, but it's also, like GiveWell, concerned with ranking charities according to their cost effectiveness. So many of you, I mentioned careers, many of you are at a crucial stage right now of figuring out what to do with the 80,000 working hours that you have ahead of you. It's a really important question. What good, how much good can I do with those 80,000 hours? And how much good can I do consistently with remaining a happy, insane person also? You might be interested in checking out another effective altruist organization called 80,000 Hours. The idea behind 80,000 Hours is to encourage people to think outside the box about how much good they can do with their career. So if you ask someone, what do you suppose is the most ethical career? If you want to do good in the world, what career should you take up? And people will give answers like doctor, aid worker, teacher. They'll list careers where you would be directly helping someone. But people seem to miss that you could do good without directly helping people. So you could take up a career as an investment banker. And then you could donate 10% of your income to the most effective charities you can find. And you can imagine 10% of an investment banker's salary versus 10% of an aid worker's salary, there's just no contest. The investment banker is going to be doing a lot more good. I'm just zooming in on that aspect of things. And it's also important to pay attention not just to the amount of good that you would do, but to the difference in the amount of good that you would do compared to the good that would have been done if you didn't do the good that you did. So if you are a doctor and you save a life, you got to ask, would that life have been saved if I didn't save it? The chances are, if you didn't take up your job as a doctor or an aid worker, that somebody else who's just about as good as you would have done so instead. So all that good looks like it would have occurred in the world anyway, even if you hadn't brought it about. That's not the case with the high-impact philanthropist. It's just not true that if you didn't take up this career as an investment banker and then donate a bunch of your money to charity, that good would have been brought about anyway. So if you take up certain careers, not only do you have more money to give, but you're less replaceable in a very important way. Now, hearing all this, you might think, gosh, this is a good idea. Why haven't people been doing this all along? This seems very plausible. So I think there are a few explanations of why this didn't occur to people right away. One is just that, again, this is the point about helping directly versus indirectly. There's probably some psychological explanation here of how people like or prefer to help directly. You want to be the doctor that did the heart transplant rather than the person who called the paramedics that resulted in the doctor performing the heart transplant. Now, that's not a morally relevant difference. You'd be just as strongly morally required to call for the ambulance, call for the paramedics, as perform the actual heart transplant. But it's a possible explanation of different attitudes towards these things. Another is that people have weird attitudes about money. So there's actually some very hilarious psychology experiments on this that I'll just tell you about quickly. It turns out that simply thinking about money can make you less helpful, make you less inclined to want to help other people. So in the experiment, there's some actor who looks like she needs help. I think she dropped some papers or something and is scrambling to pick them up. It's very difficult trying to put them in a briefcase, trying to perform some task that she's struggling with. And then there are different subjects witnessing this, and they can either opt to help her or not. And the subjects are primed in different ways. So there's a control group, and the control group, before they see this, just sits down in a waiting room and looks at a computer monitor that has a fairly standard screensaver, just like fish bouncing around, that kind of thing. And then the money group, they look at a screensaver that has dollar bills bouncing around. And I forgot the exact percentage, but far fewer in the money group are willing to offer assistance than in the control group. I don't know what the psychological mechanism there exactly is. Maybe you do. But the point is just that this is another possible explanation of why people haven't been attracted to this possibility of being a high-impact philanthropist as a good-producing career. Okay, so why, or sorry, should you do this? I've just mentioned how it might be the case that taking up a high-impact career would be a lot better than being an aid worker. What about the should question? Should you do it? I think whether you should do it and whether it'd be wrong of you not to do it depends on a lot of different factors. So it will depend on how much good you can do given your particular talents and psychological makeup. That's one relevant factor. It'll also depend on which careers you're looking at might cause harm or do deontologically unsavory things, to use a philosophical phrase. Or it might also depend on the cost to you in terms of your projects. Maybe you care a lot about being, a academic philosopher or something like that. Maybe you care a lot about that, and it would be a large personal sacrifice to you not to to do that and to work on Wall Street instead. Those are relevant factors. I do think that there are some cases where these factors could align such that it would be wrong of someone not to take up a high-impact career. How often that kind of case will occur, I'm less certain of, but it seems possible for a case like that to occur. It's at the very least worth your time going onto the 80,000 Hours website and carefully and open-mindedly exploring different options for doing good with your career. I had another point here about what if everyone did that and coordination among effective altruists, but maybe I'll just save that to the end of the Q&A. And I wanted to note also before I ended that another thing that you could do is you could become part of the effective altruism movement by joining a local Giving What We Can chapter. You could spread the Giving What We Can message around your university or on the internet, on Facebook, for example. I'm sure my Facebook friends know about the Giving What We Can and effective altruism message, but maybe yours don't yet. The Giving What We Can Canberra chapter is actually here today, and they have a sign-up sheet, and I'd encourage you to speak with them after the Q&A. Thank you so much for your time and attention.